let's go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everyone. We are starting the second session of the 2012 NEWH Green Voice webinar series. My name is Dina Ballon. I'm the VP of Sustainable Hospitality for NEWH. Our group has assembled the sessions being held yesterday and today, and we have a great lineup and speakers, so I hope you'll join us for all of them. During the session, if you have any questions, please type them into the comment area, the chat, which is on the bottom left corner of your screen. There'll be time at the end of the session for the speaker to address those questions. Now I'm going to introduce, I'm very pleased to introduce, John Gray, who's the CPD and principal of and the senior plumbing engineer, at Interface Engineering, and he is going to be leading this session. John.
Well, thank you very much. Water is really my passion, and I've been in the plumbing industry for 30-plus years. They're being nice to me because I've been doing this for over 35. But my passion is water and water recycling. And so hopefully today that you can learn something about what we've done in the state of Oregon. And hopefully that will give you some guidance that possibly in the future that you can work on your states to develop a roadmap, et cetera, and change things in your states to where you can reuse water, rainwater and recycled water fairly easy. So really today I wanted to talk about the path to water independence and beyond, high-efficiency fixtures. And a number of years ago, working with Sarah Architects, and I know that Clark Rockman yesterday spoke, and I do and quite a number of projects with Sarah and Lisa Pettison there. And what happened a few years ago, probably about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we were approached by the Bullitt Foundation to do a project, and that was to develop a roadmap for water independence. And what the purpose of this was for what do we need to do to knock down the authority having jurisdiction barriers and what legal barriers we had to overcome to reuse water. And it was really quite unique because we had a unique opportunity in Oregon at that time because there was a real movement at that time to reuse water, reuse rainwater, and reuse recycled water such as gray water and black water, and use that to flush fixtures, et cetera. So what we were tasked with was we developed this Oregon roadmap, and it's a pretty intense map, and this is courtesy of Sarah Architects. And this is one of our final or revised versions. And what you can see on this roadmap is where you can see the rain coming down. You can see, let me find a pointer here so I can help you a little bit. And you can see where the rain comes down and all the different uses of rainwater that we can do here in Oregon. Also, too, is the flow back down to gray water and the reuses that we can reuse it for, and then all the way to black water, and then you can track back through what we can reuse black water for. Now, these little boxes, you can see what we did was we identified, okay, what are you going to have to do when you go in and take your drawings in or you're working with the local jurisdiction? And to what's going to be the hurdle there and the intensity of the hurdle. And just like reusing rainwater for fire suppression just takes an appeal now. And in fact, I don't know whether it takes an appeal anymore or not. It probably doesn't. For the rainwater, we don't need an appeal. And for reuse as potable water, sink, and shower, it does take an appeal, and you have to meet the health department, Oregon State Health Department requirements for potable water. And in Oregon, it's been a lot of fun because about 4 or 5 years ago when we started this, I was co-chair of the State Plumbing Board, now the chair. And what we did was, in here in the Oregon, we have a method called alternate methods that sit alongside our codes. What that does is it gives us the ability as the State Plumbing Board is to write alternate methods and to be able to set those alternate methods. And they aren't part of the code, but they sit alongside of the code. So as things change over time and we want to change those, we don't have to go through a code cycle or go through anything formal. We can change those at any time so we can keep up with the times, et cetera. One good thing about Oregon is the fact that we have compliancy laws. And the compliancy laws state that basically at the state level we can set rules and regulations, and all the jurisdictions in the state have to follow that. So I can do one project in Eastern Oregon and do the same design in Western Oregon, and the code official can't interpret anything different in the code or from this alternate method. So it works out pretty good in the state of Oregon. There's only about 14 or 16 states in the U.S. that have this compliancy law enforced. Okay, it skipped on me. I've got to get my finger right here. So on the Oregon roadmap, you can see here the different. This is a little bit different look at it. And what we look at is here it goes into a little bit more definition of like rainwater, stormwater from reuse as fire. You know, we still have to clean that water up and remove the TSS and other pollutants in it before we can do that. Treatment to potable, again, is through the State Department of Health and an appeal with the local jurisdiction. These little exclamation marks are for the difficulty. So really, from an on-site bioreactor to black water to be used in a clothes washer once it's been treated, it's pretty difficult. We just haven't got to the point of, I like to call it P to T, to where we can use the effluent from a bioreactor and actually drink it or reuse it in any other ways. Even though it's very, very clean water when it comes out of a bioreactor, it still needs to go through some other stages to make it potable. This is what Orange County is doing right now, basically, is they have bioreactors for their sewage treatment process. They RO that water and or UV it, I can't remember, and then they pump it back into their aquifer to withdraw it a number of miles away from their source wells. So it's going on, but it's masked by putting it back through the ground again. Come on. So looking at reclaimed rainwater, typically our buildings, we do have an emergency connection to the city water supply. We have our rain coming down. And right now, the alternate methods in Oregon, we can reuse it for toilet flushing, fire suppression, potable water with the health department, approvals and systems, mechanical heating and cooling, wash machines, lavatory, kitchen sink, and for irrigation. So we have a broad variety of reuse of rainwater here in the state. Here again with the reclaimed water, we find that, you know, even on the trap primers in a plumbing system to be reused that way, you're constantly having outlets that you can reuse your rainwater. And as time evolved, I've worked a number of projects with 2020 Engineering, and I always love one of their slides and the different colors of water, because as we move on into the future, you know, we have black water, brown water, it has toilet water with feces without urine, and yellow water, urine nutrient-rich water. We have light gray water from bathroom, sink, shower, bathtub, and laundries, and then dark gray water from the kitchen sink. We have to watch our kitchen sinks very carefully, because if there's a dishwasher, the soap is typically poisonous. So here again with the, this is an actual brochure that's printed by our Building Codes Division, and with the alternate methods within this document. So you might take a look for this, or I can send this to you if you give me your email address, and we can get these to you, or you can look on this state site and see what we've done with our alternate methods. Blackwater, water saving with Blackwater, we find that we have a number of projects here at Interface that we've done the bioreactors and constructed wetlands, and find either one provide a high-quality effluent that we can flush toilets and use within those buildings. And the biggest thing to do on any projects is to really look at what's in front of you, which is the resource that's there on that site. And that's where we first start here at Interface, is to look what is on the site that we can use. On the black water savings, this is also known as brown water, foul water, sewage. The hardest thing with it is removing the pathogens, and the process is more difficult to process the black water, and it contains a large quantity of excess water, or if it must be processed quickly because of the high concentration of organic materials. And what we found that we use most of our black water recycled for irrigation, and we use it for toilet and urinal flushing. So here again, looking at the water balance and through the planted cell systems is how can we take our rainwater, we use it for 100% drinking water and potable uses. A few years ago, House Bill 2080 here in Oregon, we had gray water reuse and disposal. And basically, we have type 1, type 2, and type 3. And so we're able to reuse our gray water in the different scenarios, as you can see before you. The type 1 is untreated and has passed through a physical process to remove solids, fats, oils, and grease. Type 2 is treated by a chemical or a biological process to reduce total suspended solids and organic matter concentrations. And type 3 is treated to type 2 standards and is disinfected to reduce bacteria and other potential pathogens. Another project that Sarah performed, and they created the Washington Roadmap. So this is what we really encourage people that want to change in their own state, is to develop these roadmaps and really understand what are the hurdles and what would it take to change that in your state. And you really have to look at the state level, I feel anyway, because that's the way Oregon is modeled, that what comes down from the state. But even in other jurisdictions or such, that if you can get them to take a look at it, and that you're, what do you need to do to overcome the hurdles for water reuse? So again, looking at the four alternate methods, but even abroad, Interface, we've been able to influence local jurisdictions such as Shanghai. And when we were doing a project in Shanghai, we wanted to reuse the rainwater. And the Chinese engineers were like, oh, we're not going to be able to do that. It's not allowed here. And it was interesting to really push them hard to go to their local authorities and get approval, because in Beijing, you're allowed to do that. And so at the end of the day, we got the Chinese engineers to actually go and get approval. And the project that you see here is in Shanghai. The lake in the middle is my water storage tank. and that's where all the rainwater goes to and storm water goes to. So we draw out of that small lake, and that's what feeds all the toilets and urinals in those buildings. So calculating rainwater capture, and typically we use a spreadsheet and go through and we find, look at the residents, the number of occupants, the roof area, square footage, ground surface area. Yes, we do some surface capture for rainwater use if there are walkways and places that cars aren't and vehicles aren't. And you'll find that can be pretty difficult in some jurisdictions that they want it from a roof or they want it from a cleaner area. But we found here in Oregon that, at least on our projects, we'll take it from areas where there's walkway and people that occupy it. You also have to look at what's required, potable, non-potable, user baseline as a conservation level, gallons per use, and average daily water use by occupants, water quality, and if it can be gray water, black water that's produced. We've done some net zero projects as far as water goes, and it's an interesting phenomenon because you need to have your user group involved and to buy into the fact that they're not going to have as much water. One project that I'll show you a bit later, the Oregon Sustainability Center, that project, we're figuring that an occupant's going to use no more than 5 to 7 gallons a day, and that's a full-time office worker. And if you look at the EPA or sizing sewage treatment plants on site, they have about double that or triple that. And so the occupant has to be, the user group has to buy in on the fact that, oh, here in the lavatory restrooms, we're not going to have hot water. We're only going to have cold water to wash our hands. And that's allowed by our health department in the state of Oregon. So the user group and really getting to understand them and their needs is very important when you're talking water conservation. One project, one of my first rainwater projects, was a student dormitory, Epler Hall, up at Portland State. And it was interesting in the fact that we wanted to monitor every room, student housing room, for hot and cold water use and bill the students for it. And so at the end of the day, a master's student a few years after we completed the project did a thesis on it and on the water use and the energy use. And actually the energy use came back within better than what we predicted, but the water conservation wasn't as much because it was a few percentage points lower. And we feel that the reason why for that is the fact that they aren't paying for the water, so they were using as much as they wanted to use. So that's also a good idea is to meter if you got it student housing or apartments or such. Looking at the calculator and what water required versus water available, you can see on this this line right here is the total water required. But you can see where we're collecting black water, gray water, to where we have excess water. And so even on one project that I'll show later, we ended up having to provide higher flow out of the fixtures due to the fact that we weren't allowed to dispose of any storm water off-site to the public system. So we had to retain everything on-site. So we had to mask that water or whatever you want to call it through the sanitary system so the fixtures weren't quite as highly efficient as you could have, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon in this business. And also to looking at compare the water available to water provided and determine water processing, we look at the water savings by strategy, whether it's unmet water supply, roof to non-potable, ground surface, walkways to potable, et cetera. We look at very many scenarios when we're what the project's needs are. here again, looking at the calculator, you know, we look at occupancy, but this little box here, what we do here is when we download our rainwater information from NOAA or from another source, what we do is we look at the five driest years, the five driest consecutive years, the wettest years, the mean, and we look at rainfall data that goes back 50 years. And so we can look at different scenarios, like on the Oregon Sustainability Center, we're actually doing that project as the five driest years that would be five driest years in the last 50 years, because we believe if it's going to be a net zero project, it has to stand alone minimum of 5 years before it would even have to buy water. And to have the five driest years consecutively, it would be, you know, a major, major drought. So looking at recycled water at work, these four projects, Edith Green, Wendell Wyatt is a project that's under construction now and almost complete here in the city of Portland. And it's an 18-story building. Oregon Sustainability Center, Center for Health and Healing, which is a building that we did a number of years ago, and San Ysidro Land Port of Entry. This is a project that's under construction right now also. So looking at Edith Green as the first project, this was done with Sierra Architects. It's 18 stories, 437,000 square feet, and it's an office building. It's a federal building. And basically what we did with this building was it was totally gutted, the skin removed, new window curtain wall, and this unique shading on the west side of the building for the energy savings and for daylight intrusion. Up on the roof is, this is a stainless steel subroof because we built this photovoltaic field 18 stories tall, so the architects and wanted to make sure that roof was going to be up there for a long, long time. So it's stainless steel. And so that would make grade that if we wanted to drink the rainwater has to touch down on materials that are NSF listed. So this building could get converted sometime to collect rainwater and to drink the rainwater. But that's a photovoltaic field that's on top of the building. For this building here, it was unique in the fact that we had an existing building. And so we were challenged, and as always, there's challenges on projects, especially budget-wise. So being a federal building back in the day, when it had armed guards that were federal guards, and most federal buildings still do, they have a shooting range downstairs in this building particularly, and that's what this rectangular cube represents. So we have this shooting range downstairs in the sub-basement, and we thought, okay, that's a perfect rainwater storage tank. So we, it's a 170,000-gallon cistern that's waterproofed, and that's our main storage tank. And again, on this project, we aren't allowed to discharge any of the storm except for the 95th percentile storm in 24 hours. So we have little or no overflow off this system to the city system. We retain everything on site. And we collect the planter drains. We use it for irrigation, overflow to the cistern. And what we actually collect all the walkways and all the planters on this. So we have a pretty complex filtering system for this because of the organics. We also supply cooling tower water supply. So we take that from the rainwater also. And our strategies on this was low flow fixtures, but this is the one project that I mentioned that we had to actually upgrade the urinals from pint urinals to 0.5 so we would actually keep our rainwater tank full enough that we wouldn't overflow to the city. Rainwater collection and reuse and stormwater controls. So we ended up with approximately 60% water savings for this building. Looking at the pie charts here, our base, this was an ARRA goal of 20% indoor reduction, 50% outdoor reduction. And that was to use 12%, plumbing fixtures got 72%, and mechanical cooling is 16%. And with the mechanical cooling under this, with the, just the low-flow fixtures, we had 44% could come from rainwater. Irrigation was 7%. Mechanical cooling was 16%. So just with low-flow fixtures, we were right around 33% water savings. But then when we added the rainwater collection and entered that into the scenario and the calculations, we came up with 60% water harvesting and low-flow fixture savings. So on this project here, it really almost doubled our water savings by reusing the rain. And it's really kind of interesting because people think Oregon has rain just year-round. We get all this rain. Oregon's always got rain. Well, we almost go into drought scenario here in July. We get very little rain. We do get some in June. We do get some in August and some in September. But you can see where we have this huge water usage here and throughout the summer because of the irrigation. And so we are at a deficit, and so we do have to use 40% city water here. And you'll find that I've done projects in Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Georgia, Birmingham, Alabama, and love that country over there because they get steady rain pretty much year-round. Even Pennsylvania, I've done a net zero campus up at Chatham, and it's amazing that their wettest month is June. They said it was because of the hurricane season. But there's other areas of the United States that it works really well to do your rainwater collection. Here again at the Edith Green project, you can see we're in January, we've just got all kinds of water, February, March, April, May, we're starting to peter out. June, that's when the irrigation begins. And we do get some pretty good rain in June. This was our wettest June in a long, long time. So in July, we've run out, and we're basically in October, we're going to get a little burp again, but that's when the irrigation ends, and you can see the scenario here of refilling the tank, and by January, we're pretty full. So in summary, you know, we ended up with 60% potable water use reduction. Cooling tower load, we used 249,000 gallons of rainwater a year, but yet we still save 1.8 million gallons over the period of a year on this project. Oregon Sustainability Center, I don't know how many people have really actually heard about this. I see a lot of area codes up here. I have no idea where you people are. And this is a project that we started a number of years ago with Sarah and GBD, and it's slated to be the largest net zero building in the world. It's now, this is, slide is a little out of date, and it's only about 100,000 square feet, and it's about six stories. We've shrunk the building. Yet it was supposed to be funded by the Oregon University System funds and partial state funds, and the state legislature shot it down last year. But right now it's being proposed to be built by the city of Portland and bonded to sell the bonds, and we'll know in October of this year here shortly whether the city council will approve it, and then that building, if they approve it, this building will move forward. And so it'll be still a substantial building to be net zero. And again, you can see it's going to be an office building, and it's for higher education. So I can't tell you the exact number of full-time employees. At one time, it was up to 700, but I think shrinking three floors, it's probably closer to 500, I would say. And I don't know how many students. They were slated to have around 1,600 students a day go through here for lectures. and yet this building was going to stand net zero on the water and rainwater and energy, because this is a huge photovoltaic field up on top, and this would be my rainwater collection. Again, this is a stainless steel corrugated roof up here to capture my rainwater. It's a challenging site in the fact that you can see we have the rail going through here, so we don't have a whole site, a whole city block to do this building on. And it's a real challenge. This is the east side of it, and you can see where we've only got about three quarters or about a little bit more, eight-tenths of a city block to work with, because there's a three-story existing apartment building here. And so this building has, let me see, move it on here. I'll show you this one. And then move on. So this is a rendering of what the building will look like when complete back then. And I'm sure it's going to change a little bit. But really what we have on this project is we have our rainwater and gutter. It comes down, goes to the rainwater tank. We have our raw sewage tank, potable storage. On this project, we have a planted cell system. And so these are all the different components that I'm showing. So with potable water uses for the lavatories, toilets, not toilets, but for the lavatories, showers, et cetera. Here again, here's our constructed wetlands. And this is on site. So you have to realize, I'll go back to another slide here. The planted cell and actually where the sewage will be treated is on site here in these gardens. And they're right along the sidewalk. They're, you know, you can't have public access and stuff to them. So there's a break between the planted cell and the sidewalk. But it's kind of interesting that you'll be walking right next to where the sewage is being treated. Here again, inside the building, the final treatment on the sewage will be a green bryophyte wall that will be a living wall within the building. It will actually be a part of the working sewage treatment system. So that will be pretty unique in this project. Here again, other non-potable uses is for the toilets and urinals on this project. And that comes from the black water system and the rainwater occasionally. Actually, no, not on this one. The potable water only is from the rainwater, and the toilets are only flushed by the black water effluent, just to clarify that. Here again, we have an overflow dispersal area on site, and the soils in Oregon can be bad sometimes for absorption and percolating. And so we've had to design, not interface, but our constructed wetlands consultants designed a dispersal area to where we dig down so deep and put in special soils so we can take the overflow and disperse of it. Here again, looking at the water use reduction, here's our base case was 90% of the plumbing fixtures would use the use up to 91% of the potable water. Low-flow fixtures, just doing that, we got it down to 62% because the reason for that on this project is we're using low-flow urinals, low-flow toilets, and no hot water to the lavatories, just various scenarios to just cut back the water use. Using the black and gray water recycling, we were up to 80%. And then when we throw into the rainwater collection to be used, that's where we reach our 100% goal of being net zero. On this project here, we did use in the calculations, we did use the five driest years in the last 50 years to calculate this. And if and when this project does come back, one thing we really need to look at is we were using data from NOAA from the Portland Airport, And I'm a bit concerned about that because in Portland here, we have a set of West Hills, we call them. And I'm really concerned that we're sitting in a small rain shadow. So I'm a bit disconcerted by that, and I understand that Portland State University, which is right next to this site, they've been gathering rain on their buildings and monitoring that for a number of years. And so I need to go to them to understand really what is their rainfall compared to the Portland Airport, because that could have an impact on our rainwater storage tank. Right now the tank's at 215,000 gallons, I believe. And hopefully it's not a big percentage because there's not a whole lot more room in the basement to put water. So another thing we're going to look at on this project is, and people might think, well, rainwater's really clean. And overall it's pretty clean. But we'll get the water tested on this project, the rainwater tested on this project, and we'll have it, then we'll get a water analysis. And so we really understand what we need to treat the water for, because at Chatham University in Pennsylvania, which is just east of the Ohio Valley, it was interesting because we did a rainwater study there before we designed the filtering system, et cetera, for the potable water from rain to potable there. And it was interesting to find that that rainwater had 56 times the lead 56 times the amount of lead that the EPA would allow in drinking water to our national standards. So just because it's rainwater, don't think it's clean. So here again on the Oregon Sustainable Center, the annual water use, looking at the water usage and where we collected from the Blackwater and actual rainwater we gathered. And so looking at that chart, you can see where the Blackwater reuse is really the highest. You know, it participates a lot back into the system. Summary, potable water use reduction is 100%. Gallons saved per year is 2 million. So it puts a substantial hole into what we use around that area for water. San Ysidro is a project of my partner's, so I have limited knowledge on this, but I wanted to show this to you. It's done with Miller Hull Partnership, and it's really the busiest border crossing in the world. And it's a LEED Platinum plus Net Zero Water, Energy, and Waste goals. And my partner, Andy Frichtel, is quite innovative and one of the leaders in our industry as far as energy and water reuse. It's a fairly large facility, 225,000 square feet. As you can see, there's many buildings, and it utilizes many different strategies as far as energy and water reuse. Water saving measures are black water reuse from sinks, toilets, and showers for other uses. Stormwater capture for irrigation and toilet flushing, restorative landscape with drought-tolerant plants, water-efficient fixtures, net-zero stormwater discharge via green infrastructure, aquifer recharge. It has a 400,000-gallon cistern, and we collect rainwater from surface areas, from the roofs, et cetera, and it's reused in these different areas as far as the membrane bioreactor and irrigation use. The membrane bioreactor flushes the toilets, maintenance water, and we save about 28 million gallons saved a year, which is equal to 230 typical households per year, which is pretty substantial. Here again, you can see where conventional water conservation with efficient irrigation, low flow fixtures, on-site gray water recovery, the rainwater harvesting. And the interesting fact on this one is you can look at the 40 years cost savings, the payback in 33 years, 26 years, and 28 years on the different scenarios. So eventually this will be running to where it's been paid back, depending on what scenarios they finalize. Again, This is showing the cost savings for the different conservation schemes. And so you can look at the savings per year on the water uses versus non-potable. In summary, potable water use reduction is 93%, and gallons saved is 28 million gallons. So it's a substantial savings on the water on this project and for being in such a dry area. The Oregon Health Science University Center for Health and Healing, this is a project we did a number of years ago, and it's with GBD Architects, 400,000 square feet, 16 stories. And it's a medical facility and office building, and it's LEED Platinum certified. So here's a small schematic of really how the systems in this building work. Again, we used the membrane bioreactor. And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, bioreactors are so expensive, they're energy hogs. Well, they've really tamed down on their energy use over the years. And how we get these on to projects is you really need to look at the funding and what can you get from your local municipality for savings on your SDC charges. Our BES here, Bureau of Environmental Services here in the city of Portland, have been great to work with. They allow reduced SDC charges. And just like a project I'm working on right now, we'll probably have 54% savings on the water on this project, or 60%. But they only give like 30% reduction on the SDC charges. On this building here, they gave back the whole thing, 100% on their SDC charges for the sanitary, pretty much 100%. And so it saved us over $1 million, and that's what paid for the membrane bioreactor pretty much. So you need to look at ways and methodology of where can you get the money, where can you do the, design and incorporate things and look for savings across the board. This particular project here is pretty unique in the fact that we're next to the Willamette River. Overflow from the bioreactor actually flows into a bioswale and wetlands along the river. And the overflow of this bioswale goes directly into the river, because actually the treated water that comes out of the bioreactor is cleaner than the Willamette River. So the state allowed us to do that in the city. But here again, you can see we do have a connection to the city water supply, and it goes into the building and is used. And you need to understand that only the core restrooms and in this building are served by the non-potable system. All the patient rooms, et cetera, all have potable water to them. So there was a bit of differentiation there. Here again, here's a small schematic of, we're gonna gather 500,000 gallons per year of rainwater, reclaimed groundwater as needed in the summer. Potable water, there's going to be 3.3 million gallons per year use. 1.5 million goes to the cooling tower. And non-potable fixtures use 1.7. Irrigation for the building is 1 million. And then we also irrigate a park blocks across the street from it with 1.2. And the reason for that is because this building's foundation is 24/7 being dewatered. So we have a lot of groundwater that we can give up, and we can use it like for irrigation on the park blocks. This bioreactor will treat 5 million gallons per year, and the bioswales and the wetlands treatment and disposal from the bioreactors, like I discussed earlier. Sanitary sewer is 0 gallons per year, but that's a little bit misleading in the fact that you need to realize that we're set up to, bioreactors still end up with sludge in them. So you need to discharge that sludge. So part of the deal with the city and the city sewer people is that they have to arrange for, a batch dump. And so basically they set it up with the city, and then we do a batch dump to the city sewer and the sludge. Here again is a small schematic of how the system's piped and how and what it's doing on site. The bioswales here on site, we do have an infiltration facility to put water back down into the groundwater. Even though we're dewatering, we're not discharging to the storm, the city storm. So on the water use reduction, we ended up with 58% water savings due to low flow fixtures, membrane, bioreactor, and rainwater. So again, you know, reusing your rainwater in conjunction with a bioreactor is pretty efficient on reducing your water flow into a building. Gallons saved per year is about 5.4 million gallons. So it's a substantial savings for this building. So if you ever come to Portland, you'll see this tram and you'll know right where that building is. That's pretty much concludes my presentation. And this is just a list of our other projects that we've done water reclamation on. This beautiful building that's behind here is the project I'm working on right now that I described as having around 54 to 60%. This is the OHSU CoLab building in conjunction with Portland State University. It's a 600,000 square foot building, and it's very close to the CHH building I was just describing. And this project here is it's a full research laboratory for part of it, and then the remainder of it's a school of dentistry for both OHSU and Portland State University. So I could tell you some real stats on this. My plumbing designers have designed over 26 miles of pipe, and I have 22 plumbing systems on this project. So a very intense project. A lot of fun, though. So anyway, that's a slide about what interface is and what we do. And other than that, I think we just need to move on to questions.
Great. Thank you so much, John. This is Dina again, and what a great presentation. Lots of information to cover. Here's some of the questions.
I just kept watching the questions. Just
I know. So here's some of the questions that came up. How do you get past the water rights laws, which condemn saving rainwater unless you own certain water rights on your property?
Well, in the state of Oregon, we don't have those. And the state of Washington did for quite a number of years. And finally, there was enough public outcry because it's an antique law, and it was really guarded. It was guarding the farmers in eastern Washington. And so they looked at it, and the state of Washington now, it's west of the Cascades, you can collect rain and you can use it. If you're east of the Cascades, you run into that water rights prohibition. So really you have to look at what is your state requirements. Does the state own that water, or who owns that water that falls on your property? So to get around them, it's got to be at the state level, and it's got to be to where you're allowed to use the rainwater.
Gotcha. Okay, here's another one. How do you suggest people convince a building department that's not so open to some of these conservation efforts as Oregon is?
Yeah, I've been told, oh, you're from Portland. Okay, now we understand. You're from Portland. And, you know, I found on the East Coast, like in Pennsylvania and some other jurisdictions, that there's a lot of city laws or ordinances that bar you, like you're going to connect to the sanitary sewer, period. Well, why can't we have a bioreactor and their outflow will go there? No, you can't have that bioreactor. You can't treat on site. It really comes from the culture of that area, I feel, and that's where Oregon was able to move so fast, is because we had a governor that really supported a lot of this, and our governors have continued to support it. So I just recently was working in Hawaii and working with the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I was talking with the deans, and I said, well, you know, if you guys really want to do this, who do you know in government? And they go, well, what do you mean? I said, do you know the governor? No, not really. Know of him, but we know the lieutenant governor really well. And so this is where I go to the fact that you need to go to the state level. You need to get above that local jurisdiction. You need to find a way to push from above and get it done at a state level. And that's a real tough task to do. And so your local jurisdiction, if they have the ability to allow these, the best way that I found with those is to be able to go in with examples like these alternate methods that Oregon has done. You're going to do this. You're going to have the purple pipe system. You're going to protect it this way. And to show them that, you know, you're going to have the ability to protect the health of the people. Now, I know right now that the UPC, Uniform Plumbing Code, and there's IPC, and I think they're headed in the same direction to where they're going to have a green code, and they're going to actually have rainwater harvesting rules, you know, code requirements. And once we get to that point, then it'll be a lot easier if your jurisdiction adopts those codes, one of those codes, those green codes. And that way it'll make a whole lot easier for you to be able to do it in your local area.
That makes sense. Here's another one. In disaster preparedness, how could gray water be made potable, and can it be done with an additive? So, for example, you know, after Katrina, is there a way to take gray water and use it for potable during those kind of disasters?
Boy, I don't know of any without actually having the filtering system and actually having the being able to chlorinate it.
Well, that's something you ought to invent.
There you go. Then I can retire.
Yeah, the just backpack filtration system. I don't know.
Well, you know, they do make the backpacking straws that you can drink out of right out of creeks, but I'm not sure whether you could use one of those for the gray water without removing the sediment and the whatever solids are in it.
Yeah, it'd have to be a bigger filtration system and able to handle a lot more water.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Are there any hotels that you're aware of that have tried metering or limiting water and charging their guests for excess water use?
No, I don't know of any hotels. I know we've done apartment buildings and we've done student housing. We've done those type of projects to where we meter, and we've actually on the energy side, if there's heat pumps, the condenser water loop can be metered also to charge. But I don't know of any hotels. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah. How about, do you have any operational suggestions related to water conservation that don't necessarily require capital improvement, like behavioral changes?
Say that one again, Dina.
Sure. Do you have any operational suggestions on water conservation? That might be behavioral changes or something like that?
Well, just like on Oregon Sustainable Center, they don't have any hot water.
Mm-hmm.
That changes their behavior. No, actually, we'll have one lavatory per restroom. No, the on operational, you know, many of the fixtures now you can set, like on a shower valve, how far you can turn it. But usually that's made out of plastic, and if people want to break it, they can break it. But just thinking of operational, basically, I keep going back to showers because that's your biggest water hog in that type of city, you know, in an apartment or in a hotel. But no, I can't say I do.
Okay. You mentioned a couple things that I think people weren't sure about. What is rain shadow?
Oh, rain shadow is, okay, here's an example of rain shadow. Where I live here in Portland, I live on the west side of the Cascades. I'm in the foothills. So when the storms come from the west, they travel over our coast range, which forces them to dump a bunch of their load to keep moving to the west, to the east, and with the prevailing winds, and then they go across the Willamette Valley, and then they get to the hills to where I'm at, and so they have to lighten their load to get up over the mountains, so they dump rain again. And where I live, I get approximately 80 inches a year, whereas City of Portland only gets 38, so I get about twice as much. So in the scenario of a rain shadow, if you're on the opposite side of the hill that the storm is coming from, it has lost a lot of its rain before it rains on you, and it won't rain as intense. So in the case that I was mentioning, the West Hills are to the west of our building, and those clouds have to slightly raise to get up over those. So by the time they get over, they're not dumping as much rain because they've lost part of their load. Does that explain it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
And you really have to watch your microclimates in an area. If you can envision this in your mind, I've done studies on San Francisco because we have a San Francisco office. If you just place a bullseye on the city of San Francisco looking at a map, north is up, east is to the right, and you have those four quadrants. If you take the 10 o'clock quadrant and the 4 o'clock quadrant, I can do rainwater harvesting pretty successful in those areas. But the 2 o'clock quadrant and the 8 o'clock quadrant, they won't pan out. They won't pay because just those microclimates and the difference in the rainfall rates in those areas.
Interesting. Really interesting. Okay, last question. Is it required to have NSF listed roof material for potable water? And are there other materials that can be used?
Bingo. No, that's right. Your NSF is very, very important on your materials. You have to have them NSF listed if you're gonna take your rainwater and you're gonna drink it. You're gonna have to have that. So this is where the costs just go through the roof to do the potable systems, because you heard me mention stainless steel roofs and you saw the size of them. So there's a big premium there. The good thing about photovoltaic panels, that's glass, stainless steel, those are all listed as NSF. So I like gathering rainwater off photovoltaic or those type of systems because I don't have to worry about it. But unfortunately, they don't form the roof. They have gaps in between them. So here in the state of Oregon with the Department of Health, et cetera, state health has jurisdiction over the area that the rainwater is gathered, the conveyance system to the treatment system, over the treatment system, the testing and monitoring and reporting. Then it becomes plumbing code. Then it becomes plumbing. So there's a distinct area of jurisdiction by that health department, and that'll all be NSF. That'll have to meet those requirements.
Gotcha. Well, thank you so much. This was such an interesting session, and I learned a ton. We really, really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate doing this.
Oh, good. Excellent. Those who are going to be staying on for the next session, please hang on for a few minutes, and we will transition.
And I would just encourage you to see my email address. And if you have questions or additional items, one thing I try to do is to share. And the only way we can make this industry grow is by sharing. So.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.